We are back with another edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. I am your host, the loyal Nets fan, Josh Bass, and joining me, Marcus Barahal, the new potential convert to the religion of Netsdom. Marcus, we're going to get into the Nets' thrilling victory over the Charlotte Hornets, what this means for their playoff chances, what it means for D'Angelo Russell that he wasn't in the game late in the fourth quarter and double overtime, and all the craziness that ensued, and more, coming up on the Locked On Nets podcast.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Marcus, I am so excited to get into this game. Nets beat the Charlotte Hornets 134-132. They've won 9 of 10. And this game was pretty crazy. You know, it was back and forth for most of it. The Nets had a really great second quarter, outscoring Charlotte 34-22. Kemba Walker got going in the fourth quarter, just hitting his mid-ranger, his step back, using his incredible in-and-out dribble and all the dribble moves he's learned in the courts of the Bronx. But he was on fire. Really, this game got crazy in the late fourth quarter and into the first two overtimes. First of all, it starts with Spencer Dinwiddie, who took 16 threes somehow, finished with an insane 37 points and 11 assists, only one turnover, and Joe Harris, 27 points, 11 of 14 from the field, 5 of 8 from 3. First of all, before we get into all the madness, the two stars on the Nets for this game, Joe and Spence, what were your thoughts on them?
Both played tremendous games. I mean, they shared the post-game interview, they shared the glory in the game and after the game. I thought that, like you said, the 16 three-point attempts for Dinwiddie was insane. He made 7 of them, so it worked out. He still got to the line also, which was good. He had 8 free throw attempts, which led the Nets and was actually more than anyone besides Billy Hernan Gomez had in the whole game. So he did a good job of playing that Morey ball of attacking to get to the line, but also pulling up from three. The one turnover, like you said, was really good, especially considering how ball dominant he was in the game. 29 field goal attempts and 11 assists. That means that, 40 times the play either ended with him shooting or with him assisting a guy to score. That doesn't count all the free throws and the missed shots. I mean,
probably like 344. Crazy usage.
Yeah, it's insane. And Joe Harris, 11 of 14. He's just so efficient. The only shots he missed were from three. He was 27, 6, and 2. And that big steal at the end.
Absolutely, and I just want to make a quick aside of the Billy Hernan Gomez comment you mentioned, because loyal fans of Locked On Nets will remember start of last season, the Nets had Jeremy Lin still, had D'Angelo Russell coming in. Obviously, Spencer Dinwiddie had a really nice 2015-2016 season, or 2016-17 season for them. But I was saying, hey, he's a good backup, but we have a glut at point guards. Knicks need a point guard. They had Billy Hernan Gomez, who looks like a promising center before he was ruined by Hornacek. So I'm saying, hey, let's do a trade for those two. And now to see how Spencer Dinwiddie has really skyrocketed his potential and his value around the league. And Billy Hernan Gomez, who is a decent player, but the second best Hernan Gomez brother. So I was clearly wrong on that. I'm a big Wancho guy.
Wancho's good.
We'll get into all the craziness here, which, first of all, the Spencer Dinwiddie thing you mentioned. Anytime the Nets are down by three with, let's say, a minute left, he feels compelled to just turn his body and hoist from 35 feet, and it literally never goes in, except maybe once or twice it goes in, but he thinks he's this contortionist. But luckily, Jeremy Lamb, I think it was, fouls him on a three-point play. He hit 3 free throws. Then the Nets and Hornets are going back and forth. Marvin Williams is getting buckets. Nicholas Batum is getting buckets. The Nets are coming back and tying it up with Joe Harris insane threes. And then the madness starts with Rondae Hollis-Jefferson fouling Kemba Walker 35 feet from the hoop when he just kind of trips into him with 3.6 seconds left. Terrible foul by Rondae. Am I right, Marcus?
It was a bad foul, but I didn't think it was that egregious. I mean, he wasn't like reaching in like the Lamb play where it was just an absurd, like there's no reason to do that. Rondae was just kind of playing him really tight, which you kind of have to do with Kemba because of his step-back ability. And he just has the ability to generate space. You can't give him any... especially on a play like that where he's so clutch. Cardiac Kemba, as he was known in college. So I think Rondae's foul was bad, obviously, but it was understandable.
Okay. That's maybe I'm overreacting. But Rondae Hollis-Jefferson would have been the GOAT in this situation. except for Kemba Walker himself. He makes the first free throw, misses the second, which wasn't intentional, but I think it wasn't the worst move, just because since the Nets had no timeouts, there's very little chance they're going to get inside the three-point line, and missing that free throw delays them a little bit, and they can't run a set play. But Damari Carroll gets the rebound. Kemba Walker inexplicably reaches in 80 feet from the hoop, pressuring Damari Carroll, and fouls him. Marcus, this was one of the craziest plays I've ever seen. On our crazy scale, I'm giving it a 10 out of 10.
I'm 100% with you. That's a 10. It didn't make any sense. Kemba missed the free throw, and then he came up on Carroll right away, which I didn't think was that bad of a move. He like pressured him a little bit, and Carroll hesitated, which cost the Nets like a half a second or a second. At that point, Kemba should have just retreated, having caused that slight delay, and at that point, the Nets weren't going to get anything off that was closer than half court. But he, for some reason, persisted and kept reaching in on Carroll and pretty much made the refs call a foul. Carroll did that James Harden-esque swing up with his arms to kind of draw the contact a little bit, which was a nice move by him, but it just didn't make any sense why Kemba was doing that.
Yeah, it reminded me almost like when you have a my player in 2K and you like you fuck up kind of and miss a couple shots, and then on the other end you want to make up for it, so you're just pressing X, going for the steal 10 times in a row, and you just make a dumb foul. So Damari Carroll goes to the line. I was super nervous he was going to miss both and the Nets would lose. He makes the first, so pressure is gone on that end. Second one he misses, but one of the most obvious lane violations by I think every player on the Hornets. Nicholas Batum, who was the third guy in for the Hornets, clearly took three steps into the paint. Kemba Walker just sprinted in before Damari Carroll had even gotten the ball to the rim. One of the worst lane violations I've ever seen. The refs kind of had to call it, right, Marcus?
Oh, for sure. Because there's pretty much like a half step that's like given, like kind of like on traveling, where the refs don't really call it. They just kind of let it go. But this was way too egregious. I mean, Batum, like you said, pretty much dove headfirst into the lane. Kemba was sprinting in. It was just a mess, and somehow Carroll, given another opportunity, did not do anything.
Yep, he misses that. I feel like the thing with lane violations is that it's something where if the audience and people watching at home notice it, and it's obvious, that means you kind of have to call it. And until then, it's just like, whatever. But yeah, it was so obvious. They had to give him another one. He missed it. That was bad. He was going to be the GOAT up until that point. Sent us to the first overtime. Nothing super notable in that. We'll get into it more in the second segment and talk through both overtimes and what we saw there, as well as some D'Angelo Russell content and him not playing late in games. All that and more on Locked On Nets. We're back on Locked On Nets. Let's get into the overtimes a little bit. First overtime, nothing super notable. The Nets had a chance to win it at the end with 0.6 seconds left after I think it was either Monk or Jeremy Lamb completely bricked a mid-range shot that didn't even hit the rim. Kenny Atkinson designed a really nice play. Unfortunately, the timing was kind of off, and Spencer Dinwiddie was able to beat his man, Jeremy Lamb. He got between Jeremy Lamb and the basket, had a floater which rimmed out and also was released about 0.2 seconds late. So good play design there, but execution needs some work. Marcus, anything from the first overtime that stood out to you, or should we get to the madness that was OT2?
I just wanted to quickly agree with you that I thought that play design was really nice, just a half second late or whatever. But also, big shouts to Jared Dudley for calling that timeout after the Nets got the rebound with like 0.6 seconds left. They showed the replay of it, and pretty much as soon as the Nets touched the ball on the rebound, you just saw Dudley's arm shoot up into the timeout motion. It's just incredible. I just really love watching him. Seeing him hit that big three, which we'll talk about, and then run down doing his celebration, touching the ground with his three fingers. He's become one of my favorite Nets, for sure.
Yeah, I love Jared Dudley so much. I think he's hilarious. One of my friends, shout out to my boy Scott, who's a big Nets fan but doesn't watch every game. He just hates Dudley so much, and I keep trying to tell him that JD is good. So, but shouts to our boy. He's definitely made a nice impact over the last few games. So, we'll get into the second overtime, which started off, Spencer Dinwiddie hit that huge four-point play. I was going crazy. But then, you know, Nets are trading baskets. Jerry Dudley hits a three. Joe Harris made a tough step back two. The Nets are up by six with about 2.5 minutes left. I'm cheering. I'm celebrating. Drinking my white wine. I'm like, okay, we're going to win this game easily. Finally, we're breaking it open. And then all of a sudden, Charlotte comes back with a barrage. Kemba Walker gets an and-one off of not a great foul by Rhodey Karutz. Rhodey Karutz had a ton of awesome moments in this game. His block, he had a steal early in the game where he intercepted the ball and just took off for an easy dunk, and had some key rebounds as well. And overall, I give him an A- for this game, but had a couple of dumb fouls and a bad turnover late, which kept it from being an A. But anyway, so the Nets, really kind of the madness starts again when it's 132-132. The Hornets have the ball with about 7 seconds left. Chance to win it at the end, or at least go to overtime three. Malik Monk's ISOing against Kurucs, just kind of loses the ball. Joe Harris picks it up, goes coast to coast, makes the layup with 3.4 seconds left. And then Marcus, explain to us what happened with the clock, because that was absolute madness.
Yeah, Joe Harris hits the layup with 3.4, as you said. And for some reason, the shot clock doesn't reset. But also, the shot clock should have already been reset on the steal, because Harris stole it with under 24 seconds left. It was about 7 left. And so Walker brings the ball down, trying to rush up this last-second shot. He gets to about half court when the shot clock goes off. There's like 1.7, 1.8 on the game clock. He keeps going because he's a professional, you know. This is what he gets paid to do. He launches up a shot that misses, and then the Nets are celebrating. Rondé, I think I see, wave his arms as in, like, no good, this is over. And then the refs kind of huddle up and realize, oh, this buzzer should not have gone off.
Yeah, buzzer shouldn't have gone off. And then there was kind of a 3 or 4 minute delay where they didn't know what to do. I thought they were going to give Charlotte another chance to basically redo the play with 3.5 seconds left from the baseline, which would have screwed the Nets over. Instead, they get the ball coming off the side with 1.7 seconds left. It's a weird angle. Can't really do a lot there. Not much time. Ends up with Malik Monk taking a half-court shot, which didn't come close. And the win goes to the good guys. 9 of 10, great win for this Nets team, proving they can win close games against a solid Charlotte team and a team that defended them pretty well, I thought. They don't really have a great rim protector. Cody Zeller isn't the best, but have a lot of switchable wings like Marvin Williams, Nicholas Batum, Jeremy Lamb, Kate Gilchrist, and Miles Bridges off the bench, which made life hard for Spencer Dinwiddie and also for D'Angelo Russell. Let's get into his game a bit. He scored 16 points on 7 of 18 from the field. Not very efficient. No free throw attempts, 4 assists, and 3 turnovers. Played 27 minutes, but all of those 27 minutes came in the first 3 quarters and then about half the 4th. And then at the end of the game and in both overtimes, Kenny Atkinson decided to go with Spencer Dinwiddie over him. Marcus, what do you make of it for D'Lo?
Well, we've seen this over and over again from Atkinson. He just likes to ride the hot hand. I don't think it necessarily means anything about Russell specifically going forward. And Kenny even got asked about this in the post-game press conference about why has D'Lo not been out there to close games? Has Dinwiddie passed him? Blah, blah, blah. And Kenny pretty much just said, like, Russell's been out there to close games at times. I'm sure he'll be out there in the future to close games. It's just a matter of Dinwiddie had it going late in the game. Atkinson pretty much kept that same 5-man lineup of Dinwiddie, Harris, Kurucs, Rondé, and Dudley throughout both of the overtimes and like late in the fourth. So I don't think it says anything necessarily about D'Lo specifically. I think it says more about Kenny in that he's willing to ride the hot hand and just sort of stick it out regardless of who maybe is getting paid the most or who necessarily should be getting the most playing time. It's just whoever's playing the best is going to get the minutes.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, is there any point of having them both out there? I feel like it's gotten to the point where Dinwiddie, let's say, he has really proven himself. If he's not having the best game, but D'Angelo Russell is, would Kenny Atkinson, instead of just going with D'Lo, have them both out there? I feel like D'Lo just hasn't gotten the respect from Kenny over the last year or two. And to Russell's credit, he's been a really good teammate. You can see him clapping very enthusiastically, getting hype for his guys. And his defense has gotten better. He's making the most of his limited tools. His passing, I think, has been fine, less turnover prone in recent years. At the end of the day, his big thing is that he doesn't have the athleticism to effectively score, especially when it's in crunch time against long defenders like the Hornets. And is that ever going to change for him?
Yeah, I don't know. I think Dinwiddie's explosiveness in terms of getting the basket and getting those free throws like we talked about is what has made him so much better closing games as opposed to Russell, who, again, we've talked about, he had 0 free throw attempts in this game. He's just not willing or not capable of getting to the line, which is such a key part of closing out games late. And this was a real big win for the Nets, the double overtime thing. They had the loss to Memphis in double overtime during their losing streak, so this was a good kind of full circle win for them and just getting back on track.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens with Russell going forward. I think all signs indicate that the Nets aren't super high on him, and even though he's been a good soldier, they're probably not going to pay what he could get on the open market. Maybe a desperate team like a Phoenix, like your hometown team, Marcus, could want to give him a big contract. I think the Nets will probably match something up to maybe $14 or $15 million annually on a shorter contract, but I don't know if they're going to want to go 4 for $70 or 4 for $80. Just they just don't seem to have that faith in him, and this is without Caris LeVert. So once Caris LeVert comes back, he's a guy that should be pretty entrenched in closing lineups, just due to his versatility and being a guy that can beat this man one on one. So where does that leave Russell going forward? I don't know. So we'll take a break here on Locked On Nets. Coming up, we'll talk about Kenny Atkinson's decision to go with Rondé at the five and some final thoughts on this thrilling double overtime victory over the Hornets. Locked On Nets, segment three here, discussing the Nets' victory over Charlotte. What a great game. Nets have now won 9 of 10, as I mentioned. And one of the big strategy conversations from today was Kenny Atkinson going with Rondé Hollis-Jefferson at the five for double overtime, or for both overtimes, actually. Obviously, 58 total center minutes, if you will, in this game. 24 occupied by Jarrett Allen, 14 by Ed Davis, so only 38 minutes. So that means 20 minutes of guys like Rondé and Jared Dudley playing the five. Marcus, what'd you think of that decision? I know Charlotte was going small as well. Cody Zeller got benched. They did play Billy Hernan Gomez at times. Kaminsky didn't get any minutes. So they were going with Marvin Williams, who hasn't gotten any better or worse since he entered the league 13 years ago at the five. What would you make of Kenny's decision to play small with Rondé?
I didn't mind it. I thought that it was kind of dictated by what the game was. The jump balls in both the overtimes were Batum and Rondé, which was crazy. But yeah, I thought Charlotte did a really nice job when they had Hernan Gomez in and the Nets had Rondé at the five of kind of taking advantage of that. I mean, Billy had 6 offensive rebounds in just 14 minutes, which shows that the Nets couldn't really secure the boards against him, which makes sense. And then Rondé on the other end wasn't necessarily able to take advantage of having a bigger guy on him, because he's not going to post him up, obviously, and he can't shoot to kind of stretch the floor. So it was kind of a lot of just trying to break him down off the dribble, which he can kind of do, but as we've talked about, Rondé gets a little out of control on drives. I mean, the minutes thing didn't really come at the expense of Jared Allen, who played 24, which is kind of where he's been at. But Ed Davis, I don't know if you mentioned, yeah, 14 minutes for him. I liked the decision late in the game, like in the overtime, to kind of ride with the guys, but I thought in the fourth they could have mixed it up a little more.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, because I think Rondé, he has his faults as a player, to say the least, and even though he has a quickness advantage if he's going up against bigger fives, he can do it, as you mentioned, but it's still not an efficient play and one that you want late in games. You want the ball in Spencer Dinwiddie's hands or D'Angelo Russell's hands, so that's not going to happen. And then you're losing a lot of offensive rebounding ability, defensive rebounding ability, and then on a pick and roll, he's not like a vertical spacer like Jared Allen is or even Ed Davis can be, so you're losing some pop there. So I'm just thinking, if you're going small with a five that also can't shoot any threes, I feel like that should be the main reason to do it. Now you're getting a guy that can space the floor, but if Rondé can't do that, then why wouldn't you go with Jared Allen or Ed Davis? And Rondé did make some key plays. I thought he had some nice offensive rebounds, which is what he should be doing. A couple plays where he slipped to the rim and had a nice acrobatic finish on a layup, but I don't know. I don't love the decision. I think it ended up working out, and the Nets were going with kind of a trapping box in one almost scheme on Kemba Walker. So very nice adjustment there by Kenny Atkinson. And if Kenny thinks a guy like Rondé is better to have in that kind of defense than Jared Allen or Ed Davis, then it's a great decision. But I questioned it a little bit, especially when Hernan Gomez was out there, because he was killing them on the boards and led Charlotte on a mini comeback when they were able to close the game up.
Yeah, the boxing one was really interesting. I thought that Rondé, he did a decent job. I mean, 15 rebounds is obviously impressive, but when you're the biggest guy on your team who's playing, that's semi to be expected. But yeah, I just think that maybe mixing it up with Allen, trying him out and just throwing him in the way that they've done with Kurucs could maybe give him some more confidence and try to get him going a little bit.
Yeah, or even I feel like Ed Davis could have punished Batum and Marvin Williams on the boards. And for that kind of, it was such a stagnant possession by possession game, and Dinwiddie was basically going one-on-one anyway and just pulling up for three. Because I don't know, for whatever reason, he wasn't super into going to the basket. He was kind of, it looked like he saw these bigger guys that were guarding him, like a Marvin Williams and Batum, and just kind of not afraid, but he would rather just pull up from three instead of going by them by normal. So having a guy like Ed Davis in there who could really crash the glass, and you know he's consistently going to be able to get you an extra possession or two, could have been useful, but I digress. I think Kenny Atkinson, it ended up looking like the smart move for him because the Nets get the W, and they did a nice job containing Kemba Walker in the overtime, but he was really starting to cook them in the fourth quarter. Marcus, one final note on this one. Want to bring to light Ian Eagle's comments on Jeremy Lamb because his broadcasting was so funny. First of all, Jeremy Lamb, who had a great game, by the way, and has gotten a lot better since he left UConn for the NBA, he was short on a jumper, and Ian Eagle, without pause, goes, "Lamb, undercooked that one." And it just made me think of Gavin. Shout out to our boy Gavin, who is broadcasting.
R.I.P.
Number one high school prospect, James Wiseman, right now in South Carolina. And Gavin would have loved that call. So great job by Ian Eagle. I feel like he's getting more and more of a stardom and being considered the best broadcaster in the league, which I think he is. Also, most versatile. Shout out to NFL on CBS. Any comments?
Yeah, just on that terrible Lamb foul at the end of regulation. Again, without hesitation, Ian Eagle attacks. He said, "Lamb chop." I mean,
great.
What more
great.
Is there to say? I wonder how many of those he prepares before the game, how many of them are just in the moment, you know?
Yeah, I think Sean Marks needs to start considering, like, when the Nets sign or trade for players, how will Ian Eagle, can we make life easier on Ian Eagle and just set him up for more alley-oops? He's like a Jared Allen type. You just throw it up there and he's going to spike it down.
Yeah, you need to start looking and targeting draft prospects with punnable names or names that are double entendres for things, you know?
Yeah, we need to just trade up for Bol Bol regardless.
Yes, serving it up. I'm sure
that'll
come out.
With that. Yeah. Absolutely. Marcus, quickly, before we go, any Rodion's Kurds takes? Because you missed the last podcast when I went solo and discussed Rody Mania. The guy is my favorite Latvian player in the league, and I think maybe best Latvian player in New York. Come at me.
Wow. I'm not going to take that bait. Kuruks, he's really good. I thought that his block on Parker was nice, but then at the other end, he just threw it straight out of bounds. So, I mean, like any rookie, he's showing good flashes and he's contributing, but at the same time, there's still definitely room for him to improve. But I think he's good. And I think playing, I believe he played 39 minutes in this game. I mean, he's a second round pick. So for him to be doing that this early is really impressive. And he's super long. So I look forward to his development.
Absolutely. And his baseline cuts are, I think, my favorite thing in NBA history also at that, just because he times them so well. And he catches these American players that come from AAU and don't know the fundamentals and is able to beat them off the ball and make some easy plays for the Nets guard, setting him up. That's going to do it on Locked On Nets. This was such a great game. Nets are currently half a game out of the, I believe it's 7 seed. I know Charlotte and Miami are tied. Detroit's half a game above them. Have a chance to get into the playoff hunt if they beat Charlotte in the Queen City on Friday.
Appreciate you guys sticking with us. This last couple weeks or so has been a time of development, like Kenny Atkinson would preach, a time of development for myself as the host of the show. Marcus is still getting his feet wet and is a precocious neophyte when it comes to being my co-host here. But please rate and review us in the iTunes store. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On Nets. I am at JMBass_, and Marcus is at Marcus Barahal. And until then, be well.